No one has reminded me to record, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. And so we'll go ahead and get things started for this evening. So if you bow your head, we'll ask God's blessing. Our Father in heaven, we want to bow before you this evening to thank you for your Sabbath day. Thank you for the understanding we have of your way of life and for keeping us connected to you by this weekly holy time that you provide for us. Gives us a break from our rest of the week and to focus on you and to be able to fellowship together. So many blessings we receive because we're able to and blessed with keeping the Sabbath. So we thank you for that and thank you for this Bible study tonight. We do ask that you'll guide us, that you will have your Holy Spirit to be with us, that we can understand the topic we'll be talking about and to see the importance of it, the relevance of it, and just the background that helps us to understand more about you, more about who you are and how you work with your people. It's interesting to study what you preserve for us in your word, and we thank you for that history and thank you for the lessons we learn. So we thank you again, ask you to bless this discussion tonight. We thank you for the opportunity and pray to you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Okay. This is, I think, number 5 in our series here on background of the tabernacle. Eventually, we'll be talking another study or two. We'll kind of blend into or morph into our discussion about the building of the temple. And some of the history of Judah in particular as they built the temple and how they used it and how God provided his blessing on his nation through his presence. I'm going to start, I hope, by reviewing, a diagram that we first looked at last time. This is a diagram of the temple, and it shows the basic layout of the temple. We find in the chapters of Exodus the description, and as you read through it and you see how many cubits is this and that and all the different things that are go into it, it's a little bit hard to picture. So this helps us to visualize what it was that God was building for his people, or had them build, so it would be his sanctuary or his tabernacle so that he could dwell with his people. Just a quick review of the layout that we see in this little diagram. The tabernacle is enclosed with a fence that is made out of white linen, and it is 7.5 feet high all around. And even the number of posts and how they're to be set and held in place is specified in Exodus to give them instructions on making it. This fence encloses the courtyard of the tabernacle, which is 150 feet long and 75 feet wide. And so it's not a really huge area. Some of you may have seen the reproduction of the tabernacle in Lancaster. There's a museum there. And, Randy and I saw it, I was surprised that I hadn't really thought about how the size of it would be, but it's not a really large area at all, 150 feet by 75 feet. On the east end, is the only gate or opening into the courtyard. And so all of the Levites and the priests would enter at that point to go into to serve in the courtyard or to serve at the tabernacle. When you first enter the tabernacle enclosure, there's the altar. This is where all the sacrifices were made. And then just past that, here is the laver or the basin. And the Levites, the priests, when they would do the sacrifices, would wash their hands, cleanse themselves, be ceremonially clean when they performed or made the gave the sacrifice. The tabernacle itself is this tent, basically, that is situated here in this upper third of the tabernacle, of the enclosure. The tabernacle was essentially a tent, and the directions for building it show four different kinds of animal animal skins being used for the exterior of it. The tabernacle is 45 feet long and 15 feet wide. And this is, you know, it's, the tabernacle is really a very small enclosure by comparison as it sits inside, the fence that defines the courtyard. The tabernacle is divided into two sections. The front section is called the holy place. The holy place is 15 feet wide, that's the width of the entire tabernacle, and 30 feet long. So it's the first two-thirds of this tent enclosure is the area called the holy place. And we're going to see in a few minutes a picture, a depiction of what the holy place looked like with the furnishings that were in there. Inside the holy place, you'd find the altar of incense, the golden lampstand, and the table of showbread. That's in the tabernacle, in the holy place. Then at the end of the holy place is the just behind the tabernacle, I'm sorry, the altar of incense, is the curtain or the veil that separates the holy place from the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies is 15 feet by 15 feet. So it's really basically the size of a typical room in your home, 15 by 15. And the only thing that's inside the Holy of Holies is the Ark of the Covenant. And this is the area that Ark of the Covenant, and we'll talk about it, represents God's throne. And this is the area where only the high priest could enter on the Day of Atonement. Here we go. We also looked last time at this diagram. This shows the tabernacle in the setting of the camp of Israel. And you can see it situated there with the Israelites camped around it. This looks like a plume of blue smoke is actually supposed to represent the pillar of cloud that rested on the tabernacle or the, on the Holy of Holies by day, and then it was it appeared as fire at night. So this was actually likely a primary source of light for the Israelites. They had, I'm sure, their own individual campfires, but the light itself or the fire, the appearance of fire at night would provide some light then for the camp. It's an interesting picture because it kind of shows how it would look in the setting. But to me, it looks like a picture that would be like in a children's storybook. The tents all around it makes it look to me like it's a trailer park. I don't know that it was all that colorful, just like this, but at least it gives you some kind of a sense of the layout of the camp. I'm going to kind of jump ahead of myself as far as the, looking at another, the next diagram or next picture. By jumping ahead, I mean, looking at the camp as it would have appeared when the tabernacle was finished. And I thought this one really gave you a little bit better idea of how the Israelites, were set up. Numbers chapter 2, I think it is, and we'll get to it in a bit, identifies specifies how the camp was to be arranged. So you see the tabernacle here in the middle, in the center, and at this, it would be the east end of the tabernacle. This little grouping here is where Moses and Aaron and the priests set up their camp. Just, they were in this area themselves, just the smaller group, were in that area, just on the east side or east of the tabernacle. And then on the other three sides, there are the three groupings of Levites. The Kohathites here is number two, the Gershonites here at the west end, and then on this side, Merari. These were the three family groupings of Levites, and their responsibility was to work at the tabernacle. So they were grouped around it, so that they would be close there, to where they were doing their work, and also kind of as a means of protection for the tabernacle as well. It separated it from the rest of the camp. And then you see on each of the points of the compass here, the west and the south and the east and the north, there were three tribes on each of those sides of the camp. And they weren't just, you know, scattered around like we saw in that little picture we saw a minute ago, but they're very carefully organized. And, you know, there were, we've guessed maybe a couple of million people in Israelites, and they were very well organized, very structured in how they arranged their camp. And then later, as they broke camp and traveled, there also were some very specific order of things that they were to follow. So I just thought this would give us a better idea, because it's kind of hard to visualize, again, how they would have been arranged, how they would have been structured. And here we see it's not really a tornado. It's the pillar of cloud that is over the tabernacle. It represents, of course, God's presence, and that was the whole point of the tabernacle, so that God would dwell with his people. I think that's all that I'm going to be showing you for now in terms of the diagrams of the tabernacle. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the items that were prepared for and were part of the tabernacle and part of the tabernacle service. As we get to that, I just make a note or just mention that if you want to know more about the structure of the tabernacle, how it was arranged, what some of the items in it looked like, you can find a lot of material on the internet. The Jewish people maintained a great deal of detail about how the tabernacle was structured and how the service was done in it. There you'll find some disagreement a bit on some of the details, or nothing, you know, particularly startling, but some of the details they don't agree on fully. But because it's part of their legacy and part of their history and culture, the Jews have maintained the history of the tabernacle, how it was built, what it looked like, and how the priests and Levites served in it. To me, it is significant to understand, because it relates a little bit to us how God worked with his people, how God led Israel. And it shows, these pictures show some of the detail of the organization and really the dignity of how God worked with his people, how he organized them, and how they were to learn about him and to honor and to worship him. We've already emphasized that the reason for the sanctuary or the tabernacle was so that God could dwell with his people. It says that in Exodus 25, verse 8. The tabernacle would be the focus or the center of their worship. It would teach them about God. It would teach them how to worship him and remind him of his instructions and his commands. God is not to be treated in a kind of a casual or an offhanded way. He is to be worshiped and he is to be honored. Americans in general are not into anything formal. We're kind of an uncultured group of people. as a whole. We like to wear our casual clothes, and we like to think that everybody is equal. But in a lot of ways, of course, that's true. But there's a structure of as well to God's way of life, and we see how He chose to incorporate that into what He taught to the Israelites. We also should consider that when God brought Israel out of Egypt, they needed to learn who God was. They needed to learn how to relate to Him, and they needed to know how to connect to Him. And God introduced Himself to His people. They panicked. They were afraid of God. You can read in Exodus 20, after He gave the commandments, that they begged Moses to go and talk to God so they wouldn't have to, and then he could come back and report to them what God had told him. They were terrified of His power when they actually saw Him, and they wanted to be distant from Him. God wanted to dwell with His people, but His people didn't especially want God. And that was something that really was a part of their downfall throughout their history. So God established the covenant in Exodus 20 through 23. It was formalized in Exodus 24, and we reviewed this in the last study or two, how they had the ceremony and they had more sacrifices, and they formalized the covenant in verses 3 through 8 of Exodus 24. But of course, within weeks, while Moses was on Mount Sinai, they rejected God, and they broke and rejected their covenant with Him. And in chapter 32, they did something truly amazing. They built a golden calf and declared that this was the God who had brought them out of Egypt. It's no wonder that God was so angry with them after just a few weeks that they just totally rejected Him. And they decided that Moses, of course, was dead. Moses was gone. What were they going to do? And they had no connection to God. They rejected Him. We know that He almost decided just to destroy the whole nation and start over again, just through Moses. He decided not to do that, but then He decided He was not going to be with them. He was not going to travel with them. Instead, He would send an angel to accompany them or lead them to their promised land. Now, this was something that Moses especially and the people in general were very concerned about. They wanted God to be with them. They had come to some degree of repentance, and they wanted to have God go with them. So again, He relented in that regard as well. And He did choose to travel with them and to dwell with them. In Exodus 32 through 34, the covenant relationship is restored. After the people had broken it, God reestablishes His covenant with them. When the tabernacle was finally built, again, it was intended to teach them how to worship God and to remind them of the covenant that they had with Him, to teach them to honor God and to worship Him properly. Now, we're going to continue using that term, that they were honoring and worshiping and being led by God. But I want to remind you that the God that who led them, the God who was leading them, was Yahweh. He introduced Himself to Israel. I'm going to turn to that in Exodus 3, verse 14. Moses said, well, the people are going to ask me who God is, or who you are, if you want to take them out of the land of Egypt. And God said this to Moses. God said to Moses, I am who I am. Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. So God introduced himself by simply saying, I am. And it means that he is, he always is and always will be. He's an everlasting God. And his name is Yahweh. We also note in John chapter 8, verse 58, and just kind of taking a very simple, make this a pretty simple explanation just with a couple of verses, but there's more to it that we can add. But in John 8, verse 58, Jesus was having a debate or argument, as he often did with the Pharisees or the Jews. And he makes a statement in verse 58. Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. So Jesus was claiming at that moment that he was the God of Moses that was introduced in Exodus chapter 3. And the people, of course, the Jews recognized that. And they considered that to be blasphemy. And they were, at that point, attempted to stone him to death for his blasphemy. So Jesus Christ is the God who led Israel. We also see that in Paul's writings, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 talks about how Israel came through the Red Sea, and they drank of the spiritual rock, it says in verse 4, that followed, and that's really a terrible translation. It actually is the opposite. It means that the rock led them, the rock that led them, and that rock was Christ. So it's clear that Christ is the God of Israel, and that's introduced here in Exodus 3, and he is Yahweh. That's part one of the roles that he plays in order to lead mankind to salvation. He was that God that led Israel. Now, in times past, you may have heard it said that Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament. I think we've actually refined that. I know we have. We've refined that statement because God the Father is also mentioned in the Old Testament. And sometimes it's even a little bit difficult to kind of see for sure when there's a reference to God. But God the Father is mentioned in the Old Testament, as is Yahweh as God. So the correct way to understand it is that Jesus Christ is God in the Old Testament, but he's not the God. In other words, God the Father is also represented or spoken of in the Old Testament. That Jesus Christ is the one who is God to them, and will, you know, it's kind of awkward sometimes to try to separate, you know, which one is being referred to. So we just, of course, use the term God because Jesus, the word at that point was Yahweh, leading Israel. It's also, I think, helpful to keep in mind the timing of what's happening here as Israel is proceeding in these early stages of their history. From Exodus 14 on through all of the rest of Exodus, all of the book of Leviticus and the book of Numbers up to chapter 10, that section of scripture covers the first 14 months after Israel came out of Egypt. 14 months is covered from that Exodus 14 through Numbers 10. So when you get to Numbers 13 and 14, Israel had broken camp and had traveled after the tabernacle was finished. Follow the timeline through Numbers, you find that Israel came to Canaan for the first time when they could have gone in. Remember, they sent the spies into the land and they came back with this report and they scared all the people because they were afraid of the inhabitants of the land. There were giants in the land. That first opportunity to enter Canaan was about 18 months after they had left. It was in the fall or the autumn of the second year. And so we find then that most of the time, almost all of the time that Israel was in the wilderness, the next 39 or so years, is covered just in that second half of the book of Numbers, starting in about chapter 16. So there's not a lot of detail about Israel's travels while they were in the wilderness, although chapter 33 gives you kind of a point-by-point listing of where they moved to and how they moved during the time that they were in the wilderness. So they begin to receive instructions about settling Canaan in chapter 33 of Numbers, and it continues on to the end of the book. And then the entire book of Deuteronomy is instruction that was given to them mostly by Moses just before they entered the promised land. So, in terms of the amount of history or detail that's given, there's more given about this first year of 14 months, than there is at any other stage really of their time in the wilderness. And that's what we're looking at here when we talk about the building of the tabernacle. Leviticus, there's no date or time that's associated with the book of Leviticus. But if we look at chapter 40 in Exodus 40, verse 17, Exodus 40, verse 17, says, "It came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up." So the tabernacle was built, was completed 2 weeks shy of their first anniversary of leaving Egypt. Remember, they left Egypt on Passover. And then, so this is the first month of the second year. So the first year is finished, the first month of the second year, and the first day of the month. So 2 weeks after this date that's shown here would be the Passover. So we see that in Exodus 40. Now compare that with Numbers, chapter 1, verse 1. Numbers, chapter 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of meeting," because by this time the tabernacle has been built, finished, "in the tabernacle of meeting on the first day of the second month of the second year." So Numbers begins 1 month after the end of the book of Exodus. And Leviticus, is in here in between, with no date that's associated with it. I would suggest, my sense of this is that while the tabernacle was being built, during that time the tabernacle was being built, and maybe continuing for the first month afterwards, the Israelites were being given the instructions that are recorded in the book of Leviticus. When you look at what's in Leviticus, you see that God was teaching these Israelites who had totally lost any sense of who God was and how to obey him. He brought them out of Egypt, and God in the book of Leviticus was teaching them how to be his nation. Again, this is during the first year after they had left from Egypt, and they had really not a clue. So God gathered them in the desert, gave them a job to do, building the tabernacle. And during that time, I would suggest he was also revealing to them what the instructions are that are in the book of Leviticus. Without going through it in any detail, just look at a quick kind of an overview of what's in the book of Leviticus. The first seven chapters define the sacrificial system, all the ways, the different kind of sacrifices, how they were to be offered, again, teaching them how to worship God, how to seek His forgiveness, how to show thanksgiving to Him. The various offerings or sacrifices are described in those first seven chapters. Chapter 11 talks about the clean and unclean meats, what they should eat, what they should not eat in terms of meat. Chapters 12 through 15 give physical hygiene laws, how to handle certain physical health issues and problems. And includes, of course, the principle of quarantine. Chapter 16 in Leviticus details the special ceremonies that take place on the Day of Atonement. Chapters 18 and 20 give laws regarding sexuality and morality. This is the first time that Israel is told who they should not marry. It talks about incest and not marrying too close within your family. So that was the first time that that was to be introduced to them. There also are very clear laws in this context against homosexuality. Chapter 19 in Leviticus, I think, is especially interesting. It reads almost like a chapter from the New Testament. It begins, Leviticus 19 begins with the statement, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Now that's a statement that's quoted as instruction to the New Covenant Church in 1 Peter chapter 1. "Be holy, for you be holy, for I, your God, am holy." You read through this chapter. It's just kind of it's almost like one of Paul's letters. It's like a bullet list of instructions for how to handle and deal with specific kinds of situations, how they live together, how they worship God. The phrase, "I am the Lord," in other words, "I am your God," is used at least a dozen times throughout this chapter. So it's a very specific and direct instruction on how to, again, how to be God's people, how to be God's nation. Chapter 20 is interesting also. In verse 21 through 24, I won't read it, but there's a section here that reminds them that now you are God's people. You are not to be like or to worship the gods of other nations. You're to be separate. You're to be different. That reminds you again very much of the instructions we have in the New Testament. In John 17, Jesus emphasizes that we are sanctified by the truth. We're different. We're separated. We're not part of the world. That's something that Jesus emphasized. Chapters 21 and 24 give more guidelines for the priesthood. The land Sabbath is in chapter 25. The blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience are outlined in chapter 26. And in chapter 27, we find the principle of tithing is introduced. So Leviticus, to me, is very much a handbook on how to be the people of God, how to be God's nation. And so I think it is at least worth noting that when they were building the tabernacle, they were being given this instruction. God was going to dwell with them when the tabernacle was completed, and they are going to be His people. They're going to dwell with Him. So let's talk a little bit about then the tabernacle. We're going to talk about the furnishings of the tabernacle for the most part. We've seen the basic structure and the layout, what it is. And we're not going to go into all the detail about the building of the tabernacle, but we'll look at some of the furnishings that go into the tabernacle. The instructions for building the tabernacle were given while Moses was on Mount Sinai for the first time. And you find that here in Exodus, beginning in chapter 25. Chapter 25 through 31, we find a fairly detailed description of what the tabernacle was to be and how it was to be constructed. And we find in that context as well that God chose certain people from who had skills already, and He enhanced those skills with His Holy Spirit so that they could have the skills needed to build the tabernacle. So the instructions for building it were given when Moses was on that mountain for the first time. That's again in chapters 25 through 31. But of course, the building of the tabernacle was interrupted by the golden calf incident in chapters 32 and 33. After God overcame his anger and settled down and decided to be with Israel, Moses went back up the mountain for another 40 days. And during that time, the broken covenant was renewed. So finally, then when Moses returns from down from the mountain, the covenant has been reestablished. So just to put a little bit of a timeline to it, they had traveled for 7 weeks when they first left Egypt to get to Mount Sinai. We know that the law was given. We understand on the day of Pentecost. So that's 7 weeks after they had left Egypt. So Moses goes up the mountain for 40 days. That's almost 6 weeks. And then after that, there's maybe how long was there between the time when Moses came down from the mountain and God punished Israel and then he reconfirmed that he would continue to be with them? I'm going to say maybe another 2 weeks for that period of time. I'm just guessing. And then Moses went back up the mountain for another 40 days. So we understand then it was about 20 weeks after they had left Egypt when the work on the tabernacle was begun. And as we saw in Exodus 40, it was completed just 2 weeks shy of of 1 year after they left. So that means that it took about 30 weeks to build the tabernacle. Okay, I want to go back here to some more artwork. If I can figure out how to do that. There's my screen. Sorry, this computer program doesn't want to cooperate very well with me. There we go. The first item that was built to be part of the tabernacle, one of the furnishings of it, is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant, is depicted in this picture. It's not the best because the Ark of the Covenant was actually covered with gold, and this looks like plywood. But it does at least give you a sense of the size, the relative size of the Ark of the Covenant, and then on top of it here, separate actually from the Ark of the Covenant, is the lid or the top of the Ark of Covenant, which is called the mercy seat. So both the Ark and the mercy seat were actually had overlaid with pure gold. So it's a very beautiful little box is what it really amounted to. It's described in chapter 25, verses 10 and 11. They shall make an ark or a box, a container of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits. So be its length, a cubit and a half its width, and a cubit and a half its height. We decided to use 18 inches as a cubit. That's fairly standard. So the box was about 45 inches long by 27 inches wide and high. So the width and the height were both 27 inches and the length is 45 inches. It's made out of acacia wood. Acacia is one of the few kinds of trees that would grow in the Sinai wilderness. And so since it grows in the desert, it's a very sturdy, very strong, very dense wood. It's a hardwood, and it is resistant to decay. The wood actually contains substances that make it unpalatable to insects. Insects don't have any interest in acacia, and it cannot be penetrated by water because, again, it's so dense. So as you read through these chapters of Exodus, you'll see that the only kind of wood that is used in the tabernacle is acacia, both because it is the only kind of wood that's available as they're out in the desert, but also because it would be something that would last. And the tabernacle continued to be used for 400 years before the temple was built. And so God had some pretty good quality material that he gave them or told them to use. Of course, there are rings here on either side of the ark. Poles are put through these rings. The poles are also made of acacia and also overlaid with gold. The ark is a holy object. It is not to be handled, is not even to be touched. That's why the poles are used. And even very few people were authorized to actually carry the ark using those poles. So remember that when David tried to bring the ark back to Jerusalem, he didn't follow the instructions, and the ark was put on an unstable wagon, and it started to fall. So Uzzah reached out to save it from being falling to the ground. That would seem like a logical thing to do. But since it wasn't to be handled that way, Uzzah was struck dead for having touched the ark. That, of course, was very frustrating and confusing to David until he finally sorted it out. You find that story in 1 Chronicles 13. So the Ark of the Covenant was a very special item. Let's drop down to Leviticus 25 to verse 10. That's where we are. That's the description of the ark. And so it kind of describes some of the details of how it is to be constructed. Then verse 16, at the end of the instructions, it says, "And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you." The testimony is not an item. The testimony refers to the set of items that were to be placed inside the ark. That was the testimony. And so it was only to have certain items that were placed inside of it. You can compare this to Hebrews chapter 9, verses 3 and 4. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 3 and 4. And you see then that the items that were placed inside the ark were the tablets of stone, and that would be the second set of tablets, which Moses brought down from the mountain on the second time, the second trip, which were inscribed by God. Those tablets of stone, had the Ten Commandments inscribed on them. A bowl of manna was put inside the ark. And it says that Aaron's staff was put inside the ark. Now, this is where we find some kind of, I don't know, maybe a discrepancy or different explanations. Some said that the manna was replaced from time to time. Others point out that Aaron's staff would have been too large. It was like a walking stick, probably 5 feet or so in height at least. That would have been too big, too long to fit inside the ark. So perhaps it was put in front of the ark. Some of these details, it really, honestly, are not all that clear. But that's the Ark of the Testimony. And here on top of it then, with these cherubim carved onto it, is the mercy seat. That's described at the beginning in verse 17. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits. Well, okay, so it's the same dimension as the ark, so that it sits on top of it. And on top of the mercy seat are the cherubim with their wings stretched out to cover the mercy seat. Verse 21, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. In the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. The representation of God's instruction to them would be placed in the ark. Now, verse 22, and there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I will give you in commandment to the children of Israel. So this would be really most specifically how God would dwell with his people. He would speak to them from the mercy seat, and this is where he would have been when he was speaking with Moses and giving him instruction, and that's why it's called in another kind of a context, the tent of meeting. It's the place where God would meet with Moses to give him instruction. Now, the Ark of the Covenant has a pretty exciting history of its own. I would just suggest maybe if you want to look, use an electronic concordance, a Bible concordance, and just look up the phrase Ark of the Covenant, and you can see that it had some adventures. Since it represented God and his presence with Israel, it was used in a number of ways. The priests carried it over the Jordan River when the Israelites entered the promised land. The Jordan River in the spring of the year when they were entering, was very high, running rapidly, very swift, and the priests carried the ark into the river. As soon as their feet touched the river, the water stopped, and then they stood in the middle of the river while the people passed by. This was, again, evidence of God's presence and how he was leading and caring for them. It was used when they marched around Jericho. On the seventh day, they carried the Ark of the Covenant, and there was the blowing of trumpets, and the walls collapsed. The Israelites lost the ark for a while. They took it into battle because they wanted to have God's blessing, but they lost that battle to the Philistines, and so the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this is in 1 Samuel, chapters 4 through 6. But the Ark of the Covenant, wherever they placed it, the people would be plagued. There'd be plagues on the people wherever the Philistines, and they moved it from one city to the other, trying to find people in one city the Philistines didn't want it. They gave it to the other city, Gath, Ekron, the major cities of the Philistines. And wherever it went, it brought a plague on the people. So they finally loaded up on a cart, hooked an ox to it, slapped the ox in the backside, and sent it off into Israel to return it to the people. And then there was David's attempt then to return the ark to Jerusalem that ended in tragedy. So the ark, it was used as, since it represented God, in some very different, very special ways. Not to be confused with anything to do with Indiana Jones. He really told an interesting story, but the Ark of the Covenant is something that is not fictionalized. So this is the Ark of the Covenant. Let's talk a little bit about then the next part of the that we can review here is the holy place. The Ark of the Covenant was the only item inside the Holy of Holies. This And that's the back third, the furthest back in the section of the tabernacle. The front two thirds of the tabernacle is called the holy place. And the ark, the picture we saw of the Ark of the Covenant, and now this picture of the holy place are both from the replica of the tabernacle at the Mennonite Museum in Lancaster. So here in the holy place, I've seen some things here to look at. This dark thing, this bar in the middle here, is one of the pillars that holds the tent in place. So it's kind of in the way here. To the right of that pillar is the table of showbread, and we'll talk about what that represented. To the left here is the candlestick. Again, you can see how elaborate it is. They did a better job of depicting the candlestick than they did of the ark, because it also has gold overlay, but here at least it looks something like that. This little table here was where they stored the utensils they used to maintain the candlestick. There was snuffers and wicks and whatever they needed to keep it functioning. And this in the back here, like a little lectern, is the altar of incense. And the incense itself is burned here on the top of the altar. These little, you can hardly see them, but these little containers were actually the altar, the little portable, tiny altars where incense was burned. We'll talk about just a little bit of this furnishing here, in the time we have. Let's talk about the table here that has this, the showbread on it. This described in the instructions in Exodus 25, verses 23 through 30. The phrase showbread, showbread is a little bit strange. What is that? It simply means the temple bread. It was bread that was holy, and it was used and provided for the temple. The table itself, like a little coffee table, is 36 inches long, 18 inches wide, and 27 inches high. So again, it's made out of acacia wood, and it's covered, overlaid with gold. Some of the details of it are given in Exodus 25, verse 35, Exodus 25, verse 35, and also Exodus 37, 10 through 16. So, not going to take the time to read those instructions. You can, if you'd like, give us a little bit more detail about the table of and the how it's to be constructed. What was showbread or temple bread? Here's a quote from the Fawcett's Bible Dictionary in their article called Showbread. Says 12 cakes of unleavened bread arranged in two piles with a golden cup of frankincense on each. That is a quote in the dictionary from Josephus. So there you can see the stacks of bread on the table, and this container here has the incense, and these are what rests on the table. The bread was renewed every Sabbath. Fresh bread was put out each Sabbath, and then the loaves that were there all week, the stale loaves, were given to the priests. So only the priests could eat the showbread. The 12 cakes or little loaves of unleavened bread, of course, represent the tribes of Israel, and that they're continually before God's, in God's presence. So this is just a special bread. It's actually the recipe for the bread is given in Leviticus 24, verses 5 through 9. This is the bread that was there to represent God providing for the tribes. And it's unleavened bread, by the way. It's actually a form of a matzo. This is according to a website called Shabbat.org. There's an article on that website, Shabbat, Shabbad.org, an article on the temple bread or the show bread. At the back of the holy place is the altar of incense. It has these bowls on the top, and that's where the incense was actually burned, so that it would pre-create a pleasant fragrance that filled the temple or the tabernacle. It was burned twice a day, at the time of the morning sacrifice and at the time of the evening sacrifice. Fresh coals from the altar out in the courtyard from the sacrifices were brought in, both in the morning and in the evening, and that was the heat or the fire that was used to burn the incense. You may remember, again, the story of Aaron's two sons. It says they brought strange fire into the tabernacle. They did not use the coals from the altar as they were supposed to. They brought in a different, they created fire or the heat differently, and they just didn't do what God had told them to do, and they were both struck dead for having done that. And there is a very special ceremony involving the incense that is part of the Day of Atonement rituals. So this, I'm just kind of summarizing. This is given in more detail in Exodus chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. Exodus 30, verses 1 through 10. Just as a note, in Revelation chapter 5, verse 8, Revelation 5, verse 8, golden bowls of incense at God's throne are said to contain the prayers of the saints. So, you know, our prayers are are represented by the burning of this incense. And, of course, very symbolic language in Revelation, but it's the same, apparently the same point or the same principle, that this incense that goes to God's throne from the tabernacle ceremony twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, representative of the prayers of God's people that go up to him. And it's a sweet smelling thing for God, and he appreciates and cherishes those prayers of his people. And then lastly, over on this side is the golden lampstand. Exodus 25, verse 3 begins to describe it. It's very ornate. There's some very specific and detailed instructions about the decorations that are on the stems of the lamps themselves. It's very detailed in the way that it was constructed or fashioned. And again, it is made out of pure gold. And I mentioned last week that, you know, the people of Israel gave to Moses the resources that were used to build the tabernacle. And of course, as I mentioned, you know, God used the wealth of Egypt to create his tabernacle, which is at least a bit of irony. The lamp was lighted at sunset or at the evening sacrifice, Exodus 30, verse 8. And it was kept burning all night. One of the responsibilities of the priests, it says in Exodus 27, verse 20, was to burn the candles all night long. There's no mention about whether they were kept burning during the day. If they had to be lighted at night, then apparently they were not. Josephus claims that three of the candles were kept burning during the day. But there's really no scriptural reference to that. It's just something that Josephus had put in his history. Leviticus 24, verses 1 through 4, gives kind of the recipe for the oil that was burned. It was a very specially prepared olive oil, and it was only to be used in the lamps. And that was the only oil to be used in the lamps, and it was not to be used for anything else. A very special form of fuel that was prepared for those lamps. And again, they were kept burning through every night, and that was the responsibility of the high priest in particular to maintain that. So those are the three primary items that are in the holy place. This depiction shows a priest standing here at the altar of incense. It is supposed to depict again the special clothing that was actually, this is the high priest that is depicted here, because you can see he has on this vest that has the 12 stones representing the tribes of Israel. So there's actually several chapters, a couple of chapters in this description of the temple and its furnishings that describe the special clothing that the priests were to wear. That's what this picture in part then depicts. Back here is the veil or the curtain that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And so behind this curtain is where the high priest alone would go once a year on the Day of Atonement. And this is the veil then, although this is the tabernacle, not the temple, but in the temple they had the same arrangement with the holy place and the Holy of Holies, and the veil was torn when Jesus Christ was sacrificed. But again, that was the temple, not the tabernacle. Just note here also that there's no indication in the instructions for the tabernacle about a floor. So when they would set up the tabernacle, they would simply smooth out the ground in the desert where they were, and then establish or put the tabernacle erected and put it in its place. So next time we'll talk a little bit about how the tabernacle was moved when it was time for them to break camp move along. So we'll talk a little bit about that. I also want to emphasize next time the priesthood. Who were the priests and who were the Levites who served in the tabernacle? There's, as I said, as we saw from that one diagram, how that Israel how Israel was so carefully organized, the way that the camp was set up. The Levites were very carefully organized as a group to serve at the tabernacle. And we'll see a little bit about how, what their responsibilities were and how the Levites are, you know, separate from or have a different function than the priests themselves. So there's, you know, a little more detail to review in terms of the tabernacle, its structure and its organization. We'll leave it off there for now. We're a little after eight. Again, to me, the history of the tabernacle, how it was structured and how detailed and how specific God was in the way that he had them build the tabernacle, in the way that it was used, in the quality of the tabernacle that it lasted under some pretty relatively harsh conditions for over 400 years until the temple itself was built. It's really an amazing structure, and it did help, or at least was intended to help the Israelites learn more about and to know how to serve and how to worship God. It's also relatively simple. I was surprised, at how small it is and how few items there are inside the holy place and the Holy of Holies, and then the altar in the courtyard. So it's it's an interesting structure. God designed it and specifically gave instructions on how it was to be built. And we'll continue talking about it as we move on to our next study. According to the calendar, we should be able to maintain the two studies a month pace. So we'll plan on having our next study at the end of, or actually, in 2 weeks, and we get into February. So I'm going to unmute everyone, and if anyone has any comments, questions, or suggestions, you're welcome to let us know. People are leaving the building, so I guess there aren't any particular questions.
I thought it was interesting that Judah was the tribe that was in front of the opening to the tabernacle. And, of course, that was the tribe that Christ came from.
Yeah. There are probably a lot of specific details that we would maybe identify, maybe not even recognize, because God put a lot into it all around. Well, Randy and I plan to be at both Pittsburgh and Wheeling tomorrow. Hopefully the weather will cooperate, and we plan, I think, Wheeling tomorrow is the morning of the third year. Wheeling is in the morning, Pittsburgh is in the afternoon, and we plan to see all of you at services tomorrow. So thank you for joining us for the study.
And well, thank you, Mr. Hansen, for the study.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
This is Warren.
Good night.
Yes, Warren. Good night.
We happen to be there tomorrow, the weather permitting.
All right.
Hope to see everybody then.
Very good.
Thanks for the runway.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night. You're welcome. Thank you.
Everybody have a blessed Sabbath. Good night.
Night.
Good night.
Thank you, Bill.
See you tomorrow.